Good morning. Thank you for sitting all the way in the back. I'm coming to you, like it or not. So thank you so much for being here this morning. Everyone hear me okay? All right, awesome. My voice carries and projects, so I'll try not to blast you out of the room. My name is Jennifer Brown. I practice immigration law at Ice Miller, where I've been for about 19 years. I started doing immigration work during law school, right after I graduated from college in 1994. So I've been in and around this work for a really, really long time, and it is a dynamic practice of law, I would say. And we are in a particularly interesting period now, as you might have noticed. How many of you have thought about, contemplated, read about U.S. immigration law and policy more in the last 18 months than you have at any other point in your HR careers? Okay, that's what I thought. And how many of you are what I would characterize as sort of regular users of the U.S. immigration system? So the employers that you work with, regularly sponsor foreign nationals. Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. So U.S. immigration is kind of like the tax code. It's big and deep and broad, and we could talk about a thousand different things. And you might get a little whiplash during my remarks today because there are a lot of different things that we could cover. I've tried to give you a smattering of things that I thought might be of interest to you. We've got about an hour and 15 minutes. I certainly should have time to answer questions, so I hope whatever burning immigration question you have, that you'll bring it to me. It's so interesting to me to hear what your experiences are, what your perspective is. Now, a forewarning, some of my remarks today will be unpleasant. If you want a more uplifting message, I would highly encourage you to attend the Delivering Happiness keynote closing speaker tomorrow, particularly the breakfast. I'm introducing that keynote's closing speaker at the breakfast, and I'll be happier because the content is happier than probably what I have to share with you today. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. So I mentioned that the complexity of the immigration code is similar to the tax code, and this is part of the reason why. We've got a lot of hands in the U.S. immigration system. So routinely, we interact with a number of federal agencies, not just a little, but often a lot. The most common federal agency that you all are probably familiar with, to the extent that you're working with U.S. immigration matters, is Citizenship and Immigration Services. So pre-9/11, it was just the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service. Post-9/11, the INS, under the Department of Justice, was trifurcated into three distinct sub-agencies under the newly created Department of Homeland Security. So now we have, within immigration, three different branches: Citizenship and Immigration Services, that's really the benefits arm of the Immigration Service. This is who we seek immigration visa status from through filing for benefits, immigration status approvals in particular. ICE, those are the people that carry guns and drive black sedans. Probably not all of them, but a number of them do. More law enforcement component of U.S. immigration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and CBP, Customs and Border Protection. These are the ports of entry agents that you encounter, some pleasant, some not so pleasant, when you come through the U.S. border, whether you're a U.S. citizen or a foreign national seeking entry into the U.S. In addition to that, we routinely engage with the Department of Labor, the Department of Justice, and the Department of State. The State Department runs our embassies and consulates worldwide. So every time we get an approval from U.S. immigration, we then often have to seek a visa stamp in someone's passport that actually allows them to come into the country, and that's through the State Department. In addition to that, part of the complexity of the U.S. immigration system, and I'm telling you this because I think it's important to understand what the backdrop is before we add some additional cumbersome components to the U.S. immigration system. This is just normal stuff. This is how immigration works under existing statute and regulation. So the legal framework for our immigration system is, as is often the case when we're talking about a regulatory area of the law, statute, which is law enacted by Congress, signed by the president. I know this is starting to feel like U.S. political science in junior high. But also federal regulations and rules, rulemaking. There's a federal formal rulemaking process that federal agencies go through to interpret the statute, because sometimes the statute's not all that clear or specific. We have to actually figure out what are we supposed to do. That goes through federal rulemaking. But there's a very specific notice period that federal agencies have to give, required by law, to give to the public. You could provide commentary to federal rulemaking, and then again, this comment period. The really unique thing, I think, in particular about U.S. immigration is there is a lot that gets done every day on U.S. immigration or within the U.S. immigration scheme that is not really statute and not really even formal rulemaking in the form of federal regulation, but instead is mere policy. We're just going to do it this way. And the agencies have, and historically have had, a tremendous amount of discretion to interpret federal rules and federal statute. Some of that policy is written down in the form of memos, much in the way that the tax department might give a formal opinion letter. They're not quite that formal in the immigration agencies, but we still get often, not often enough, but often formal letters or memos that help us interpret statute and regulation. And then there's just practice, things that are not written down, but this is just the way the agency functions. So again, I'm telling you this because it's a really complicated system just on its face. And so when people navigate this pathway, there are often stumbling blocks even on the most obvious of cases. The other thing I wanted to share with you is just who are we talking about? Because I think it's sometimes confusing, complicated to even know who it is that's present in our country and what bucket might they be falling in. So this is pretty much it, although the fourth bucket we're going to talk about separately because it's its own beast unto itself. But it's really important to understand the distinction between U.S. citizenship, even whether it's through natural birth in the United States, physically present in the U.S., you are a U.S. citizen by birth then, or whether it's acquired through the naturalization process. And permanent residents are different from citizens, of course, and many of you know that, but it bears repeating because I often am explaining that to people. Permanent residents are people that are authorized to live long-term on a permanent basis in the U.S., but they're not citizens. They can't vote, and it's easier, frankly, for the Immigration Service, the federal government, to revoke permanent residency than it is to revoke citizenship from a naturalized citizen. Before we get to permanent residency, though, often the way people are temporarily present in the U.S. is in a non-immigrant or temporary capacity. And this is the alphabet soup of sponsored non-immigrant temporary visa categories. So things like H-1B and L and TN and R and P and O and F and B and lots of others that I haven't mentioned. Those are just the most common. So those are temporary visa categories that allow people to be temporarily present in the United States, and they are bound by whoever it is that brought them here, often an employer or a college or a university or some other program sponsor. So there are very much limits on their stay, how long they get to be here, what they're permitted to do, where they are permitted to do it, and for whom they're permitted to do it. So highly restricted visa classification on the non-immigrant temporary side of the equation. And then we've got this whole group of people that I can't figure out how to characterize, so I have lump them together as other people who are just lawfully present in some fashion, somehow. This is distinct from the undocumented, which are predicted to be anywhere between 10 and 13 million. So I'm talking about people who may look and present as undocumented, but in fact, very much are documented, at least lawfully present in the eyes of the federal government. So I'm talking about people upon arrival before they seek green card status in the U.S. who are refugees or asylees. I'm talking also about people who are in the process of securing green card and have a pending benefit that allows them to remain in the United States. Adjustment of status is the process by which you pursue green card if you are present in the U.S. There are also a number of special legislation categories enacted by Congress and enforced by immigration judges that allow people to emigrate. I don't do any of that work. Please don't ask me any of those questions. I've been around this stuff for 25 years and I still don't understand it. Likewise, there also are other benefits like through the appeals process, stays, some other sort of order of supervision by the immigration court system, which our court for the state of Indiana goes, most of it, some of it goes south, but most of it goes to Chicago. I also don't do that work. That's more traditional litigation. So there are other ways in which people might be lawfully present and their documentation may look quite different. There also, of course, as no doubt has been in the news and caught your attention once or twice over the last couple of years, executive action or executive orders. And the greatest example, the largest, most popular example of that, of course, is deferred action for childhood arrivals. This is an action by the executive branch to provide on a temporary basis a short-term period of time for people to be present. Likewise, not quite executive action, but functionally the same, is an award of temporary protected status. So these are instances in which the federal government has acknowledged, for one reason or another, that home country conditions are too poor, too unstable, to permit people to return home. So the most recent example of that is Haiti. So after the earthquake in Haiti, there were a number of Haitians physically present in the U.S. in a variety of fashion, right? They might have been here visiting. They might have been here going to school. They might have been here for employment. They might have been here because they married a U.S. citizen and were in the midst of the green card process and got a divorce. Or the U.S. citizen sponsor died. Lots of circumstances in which a Haitian or any other number of these people from these countries might be physically present at a time when there's a natural disaster or home country conditions, a war, for instance. Liberia is a good example of that, and so is Yemen and Syria and South Sudan and Somalia. Instances in which home country conditions are too grave that the federal government has decided, regardless of what your immigration status is or about to become, we will allow you to remain in the United States on a temporary basis. We are temporarily protecting you from whatever it is back home that's really precluding your return. We're not requiring them to stay, but to the extent that they want to stay, we're giving them this TPS that also comes with employment authorization. Somalia and Yemen were most recently extended. They were in jeopardy of falling off, and they've now been extended through 2020. That just happened in the last handful of weeks. The other categories that are really important to note that I think are of immediate concern to employers are El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. If you'll notice, those are countries from which we have designated TPS since the late 90s and early 2000s. So the original conditions for the award of TPS for those countries were hurricanes in the late 90s and early 2000s. They have continued for the last 20 years to enjoy temporary protected status. They have sought extensions, and usually the extension of TPS by the federal government has occurred at the very last minute, which leaves employers who are trying to remain compliant with their I-9 employment verification obligations scrambling, wondering, is this person going to come through with an extended employment authorization card because we're waiting on the federal government to decide whether or not they're going to extend TPS and therefore the employment authorization. It was so crazy in the 2000s and even early 2010s that the federal government, I'm not making this up, I think about it now and how is this even possible, were giving yellow stickers to put on people's employment authorization cards that they could go into the local office and secure to help indicate that, yes, you really were authorized for ongoing employment authorization because temporary protected status has been extended. We're not quite that generous anymore, so yellow stickers are out the window. Now, employees are forced to look in the federal register. Have any of you ever, Sally, don't answer this. Have any of you ever looked in the federal register? I know Sally has. That's why I told her she couldn't answer. Okay, the rest of them haven't. You have, haven't you? Yes. So that's where people look to see if their temporary protected status has been extended or not, is in the federal register. So they have remained compliant for 20 years to continue to extend temporary protected status, monitored that, continued to get employment authorization, and they have never pursued anything else because most of them, frankly, don't qualify for anything else. These people have been folded into the fabric of the U.S. economy, and now we've got about 300,000 temporary protected status employees who are in jeopardy of losing employment authorization very, very quickly, and we might feel that in the American economy. So I'm going to talk just a second. Again, this is, forgive me, there's a little randomness to this order. I did the best I could. I often get questions about why people don't just get in line, and this is a nice segue sort of for transitioning from temporary protected status to this concept, because there will be people who have worked for American employers for the last 20 years who, in a very sudden way, won't have a path forward. They won't qualify for anything else, and they'll probably either fold into the back shadows or they'll leave the U.S. We'll see. But the reason for that, whether we're talking about TPS or we're just talking about people who have been physically present and have not sought immigration benefits, it's usually for one of two reasons. One reason is because if someone comes into the U.S. illegally or enters legally but has overstayed their permitted time for at least a year, they're subject to a 10-year bar. So even people who are married to a U.S. citizen who are subject to a 10-year bar won't risk filing for that green card benefit based on marriage to a U.S. citizen because they're concerned that that 10-year bar will be placed upon them. So they continue to remain unlawfully present even though they may have access to a green card. There are waivers to the bar, but they don't want to take that chance. They've lived here for a period of time. I'm not advocating or not. I'm just saying this is the reason why people aren't correcting status, so to speak, because they're subject to pretty significant bars. The 245K reference is that pre-2001, there is a window of time in which people under those circumstances or people who had employers willing to sponsor them for green card could pursue green card, and the forgiveness of that 10-year penalty was payment of a $1,000 penalty fee. But that opportunity sunset in April of 2001, and so since 2001, people have not been pursuing it because there wasn't any way to forgive it other than to qualify for an extreme hardship waiver, a little harder to obtain. The other reason why people don't just get in line, aside from 10-year penalties or 10-year bars from future immigration benefits, is that there's no line for them to get in. There are no, let's say that they're not married to a U.S. citizen, so that's out the window. There are no meaningful visa solutions for unskilled or semi-skilled labor. And so even if they had an employer who was willing to sponsor them, their options are basically nil for correcting status and pursuing immigration benefits because our immigration system is very much structured around the immigration of professionals and skilled, highly skilled labor. So there just simply isn't a line for most foreign nationals to get in to at all. So we're gonna we're going to circle back to non-immigrant temporary visa sponsorship, particularly in the H-1B category in a minute, because there's certainly been some movement around that category. But I want to talk a little bit about permanent residency, how people might qualify for green card status in the United States. This is pretty much the exhaustive list, of lawful ways to obtain a green card. So there are certainly ways to illegally obtain a fake green card, but this is the legal path. So the most common way in the employment-based world to seek green card status is through a process called permanent residence or labor certification. This process requires the U.S. employer to seek a labor certification from the Department of Labor, and the employer is required to conduct a labor market test to prove that there are no, not even one, U.S. workers qualified and available for that work. It is an incredibly high bar. It's intended to be a high bar. So my advice to employers all the time is you shouldn't be sponsoring foreign nationals for employment in this country. And if you want to keep them long term, now if you just want to sponsor them for a short period of time, fine. But most people want to stay long term, and most employers, if they make that level of investment, want the employees to stay long term. So we're almost always thinking about green card sponsorship. So knowing that the only way most people have to immigrate on a permanent basis to the U.S. is through the labor certification process, employers at the outset ought to be mindful that if you don't think you're going to be successful through a labor market test, you probably shouldn't hire that foreign national at all. Now, there's nothing in the H-1B or other temporary non-immigrant visa classifications that require you to prove that there are no U.S. workers. But if you probably are going to end up at green card, then you ought to be thinking about that at the time of initial hire, or else we're all going to be rather disappointed. The other way that's very common in the employment-based world to pursue green card is an exemption from the labor certification. So foreign professors, researchers, multinational managers, executives, extraordinary ability aliens are all exempt from, or if you're doing work in the national interest, all exempt from labor certification, but still more or less an employment-driven sponsorship. You also could make a $1 million investment in the U.S. economy, employment, including employment of 10 U.S. workers, or a $500,000 investment in employment of 10 U.S. workers if you're in a rural area. So through investment, someone could also obtain a green card. There's also a diversity lottery. This is something that's been on the president's agenda, something that he's wanting to eliminate. And there are the process is fairly convoluted. The requirements for diversity lottery are that you have to be coming from a unique place. So by definition, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, not on the list, and probably will not, India, China certainly will never be on the list. So we're looking for, through the diversity lottery, to award green card, about 50,000 green cards a year, to foreign nationals based on diversity. Now, one concern that I have or objection that I have about the characterization that there's no merit-based component to the diversity lottery system, I take a little bit of an issue with, because by definition, the paperwork and the tenacity that is required to endure the diversity lottery application suggests to me that there absolutely is some merit to that process. It is not for the faint of heart. And so for an applicant to pursue about it, actually checked this morning. Yeah, we've got about 14 million people applying through the diversity lottery program every year, and about 8 million of their dependents to join them. There definitely is some merit to the process. It is a naturally selected process just because of the detail that's required to survive. Sort of like when people arrive through the refugee system, to show up in line and do everything that's required to survive a refugee camp for years on end, to show up at our border. we're probably getting the best and the brightest just by default. So the family-based system is also quite common. So we have that really kind of falls into two different areas. There's an immediate relative path that doesn't formally require a line. There's no quota system to the immediate relative path, but this is for spouses of U.S. citizens and parents of U.S. citizens. So Melania Trump's parents recently immigrated as immediate relatives of the First Lady. There also is another family-based system that is very much subject to quotas. And those processing time, well, I should say on the immediate relative side, we're probably looking at about a 2-year wait from beginning to end to process people through the immediate relative green card path for those immediate relatives. For on the family-based side, for people that are subject to quotas, there also are per country limitations in addition to an overall quota system associated with family-based relationships. And it's not just any family relationship. So we're talking about spouses of U.S. Permanent residents, and we're talking about siblings. We're talking about married adult children. So we're still very much talking about what I would refer to as an immediate family. We're not immigrating extended family through this quota system in the family-based world. And wait times for that are anywhere, again, from probably 2 or 3 years to 25 years. This is not an efficient way to immigrate. So this concept that a single immigrant is then sponsoring well beyond the nuclear family, while theoretically possible, highly unlikely, people die waiting in line to come here through the family-based system. So it is something that's a little bit of a misnomer. And of course, we award permanent residency to asylees and refugees after they've been here for a period of time. The seventh option is if you find yourself in removal proceedings, which is not where I would want to be on the verge of deportation from this country, and you can convince an immigration judge that you are of good moral character and been here and behaved yourself for 10 years, then the judge has the authority to cancel your removal and instead award green cards. So that's through the judicial system and the immigration court system. And then there are a number of other special immigrants, religious workers, victims of crime. Violence Against Women's Act provides for a green card path, for instance, for certain foreign nationals as special immigrants. So the H-1B category is something that is really common. It is where I spend most of my time in U.S. immigration, is talking with employers in and around the H-1B visa category. So this is the most common visa category in U.S. immigration, and by definition, straight from the statute, this is for positions that require theoretical and practical application of a highly specialized body of law or body of knowledge, and also the attainment of a bachelor's degree in a specific discipline. So some of the challenges that we historically have enjoyed in the H-1B sponsorship area is, does the person have the right degree for the job? And so I do a fair amount of speaking with foreign students at universities and convince a fair number of them, if they want to stay in the U.S., to change their majors. When people graduate with general business degrees, it's very difficult for them to find H-1B sponsorship. H-1B sponsorship is tough in and of itself for a number of reasons. Added to it, this complexity of, do you actually have the right degree for the work? So H-1B works beautifully for software engineers with computer science degrees who are going to be a software engineer. They don't work very well. H-1B does not work very well for lots of other jobs that are regular, important, specialized jobs because of this issue of, does the position require a degree in a particular discipline? So when people are thinking about sponsorship for H-1B employment, that is absolutely the threshold question. Lots of other questions too, but that's really important line item. The other thing to know about the H-1B visa category is that it's subject to an annual quota. We have 85,000 H-1B visa numbers nationwide that are available. We have about 200,000 applicants for those 85,000 spots. In addition to that, the challenge is the federal government runs on a fiscal year. And so fiscal year for the federal government starts October 1. We can file H-1Bs 6 months prior to the start of the fiscal year. So we are thinking about now, in August, we're still in August, H-1Bs that we're going to sponsor next spring for employment to begin next October. So I have, at all times, all year long, a list of people that I'm either seeking H-1B status for right now, or they missed the quota, which is a lottery system, and I'm going to sponsor them again next year. It is a continuous loop, but it requires employers to be very thoughtful and to plan well in advance about what their hiring needs are. So I would say to you, as employers, if you have foreign students or others for whom you think you might want to seek immigration benefits for, you cannot, it's physically impossible to have that conversation too early. I am often talking with employers who are sophisticated in this world about what their sponsorship needs are going to be next year, the summer, or a couple of summers before. Because a lot of foreign students come and they work in the summer as interns. And so if we think that this is someone we might want to sponsor in the future, we're putting them on the list to be thinking about well in advance. Is there a question over here? From abroad. Yeah, so the question was whether or not whether this information is known to colleges and universities so that we would be able to sufficiently recruit from within our domestic workforce. This has been my mantra for about 25 years. For all of the energy, I'm going to get on my soapbox, but you brought it up just for the record. For 2 minutes, I'm going to get on my soapbox. For all the energy and poking of the U.S. immigration system that has been and is currently going on, or frankly, for all the ignoring that has been going on for the last three decades, if we had taken all of that energy and monetary value and instead attributed it to STEM education at the junior high and elementary level, perhaps I'd be out of a job. And I'd be, you know, doing my bed and breakfast in Idaho about now, right? So yes, theoretically, that's a lovely notion. I'm fully supportive. And if you need someone to get on the bandwagon, I'm your girl. So yes, it's colleges and universities are quite aware of what our labor shortages are. Our U.S. immigration system, however, hasn't quite gotten the message, and there has been an utter lack, okay, this is way longer than 2 minutes, an utter lack of leadership at the federal level around STEM education. All right, I'm done for the moment. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. So Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens that do not require sponsorship. If they are in fact Puerto Rican, yes. Not Dominicans working in Puerto Rico. They're not American, right? Excellent. Good work. Okay. So here's a little bit about H-1B employer obligations. It's really important to understand that how highly regulated this visa category is. And I'm setting this up so that you have some appreciation for the additional scrutiny that the H-1B visa category has been under. So this is longstanding obligations that employers have with respect to sponsorship of H-1B workers. So in order for, so we get through the lottery, we get through the degree issue, and we're actually engaging an H-1B worker, here are the requirements. This is not P.S. an exhaustive list. These are just the things that I think are really important. So employers are obligated to pay a prevailing wage or an actual wage, whichever is higher. So there is a wage component, absolutely, with H-1B sponsorship. And in fact, our filings for H-1B benefits start with a Department of Labor filing, and then we also do an immigration filing. Per Department of Labor requirements, we also, as H-1B sponsors, are obligated to offer the same benefits that we do to U.S. workers to our H-1B sponsored employees. Working conditions have to be the same, and those working conditions provided to the H-1B worker cannot adversely affect working conditions to the American worker. So when we see news stories about H-1B workers replacing American workers, they're in violation of the law based on this third component. So if the Immigration Service was more diligent about pursuing violators of the H-1B program, then we wouldn't need all the rhetoric around abandoning the entire H-1B program. They're also, the employer cannot be under a strike or a work stoppage or a lockout. There's also a requirement as a part of every single H-1B filing that I make on behalf of U.S. employers that we provide notice to the American workforce at that local work site that we are about to file an H-1B petition. That notice includes information about the job, the location, and the compensation, which some of my clients don't love, having to disclose compensation information. But again, the H-1B program was initially designed for the inherent protection of the American workforce. And we also have to create and maintain a public file that talks about the working conditions in terms of employment of H-1B sponsorship. So if we would simply enforce what is already there, we might be all right. So under the Buy American, Hire American executive order that was recently signed by the president, it is altering what we are doing in immigration, and it's certainly altering the immigration agency's direction around immigration policy. So the components of BAHA, Buy American, Hire American, are to promote the higher wages or promote higher wages and employment rates for U.S. workers, protect the economic interest of U.S. workers. All fantastic goals. It also goes on to direct federal agencies to reform the H-1B visa program and, frankly, other immigration programs in a way that would ensure the protection of U.S. workers. And what is a little bit troubling to me as a practitioner in this area is that there is, as I mentioned before, a great deal of discretion that the agencies have to push the envelope on what they want to do to reshape the definition of an H-1B worker. So they can do that at the agency level, or at least they're trying to, based on my experiences, to do that outside of the U.S. Congress and outside the federal rulemaking of providing notice and comment. They're instead doing it at the policy level to help reshape what the H-1B category is. So the Immigration Service is doing this, the State Department's doing this, the Department of Labor and the Department of Justice all have their hand in really reshaping what it looks like for H-1B employment. Some of that is welcome news. We need some enforcement for employers that are not meeting the basic obligations of the H-1B category. However, we're also getting a lot more requests for evidence from the Immigration Service on what really should be very much routine adjudication. It's slowing everything down and making everything more expensive, which is wonderful for Jennifer Brown and Ice Miller, not so wonderful for our clients, I suspect. So these are some of the things that we're getting pushback around on the H-1B category, this notion that perhaps we shouldn't be sponsoring for H-1B employment entry-level occupations. The problem with entry-level occupation, though, is that doctors, after residency, are engaged in an entry-level position. and this notion that we can't sponsor foreign physicians who have an MD but don't have any experience is a little tough to swallow sometimes. There are lots of occupations that technically would be characterized as entry level, but I don't think too many of us would dispute the need to sponsor for H-1B employment given some of the shortage areas that we have. We're also getting questions, a lot more questions than normal, about the degree relevancy. We're getting questions about whether the employer really has a viable business. We're getting requests for evidence challenging whether the chief executive officer of a company really is an executive. That's really hard to not be sarcastic when I'm responding. They're also asking questions around whether the employer is the one who's actually controlling the work or not. So immigration long has struggled with this notion that an employer might place an H-1B worker, or frankly any worker, at a third-party work site. But that is a routine part of a lot of people's business structure, to place employees at client sites. And so we get a lot of questions. We have to do a lot more explaining than we used to about, even though this H-1B worker is placed at a client site, it really is the sponsoring employer that's controlling and directing the work. So a lot of this has just gotten a lot harder. And that, unfortunately, is just the tip of the iceberg. So another directive that has recently come out is that the agency now has the discretion, instead of giving us a request for evidence that comes with it, an 86-day period in which to reply, the agency, in its exclusive, non-reviewable discretion, can issue a NOID, or a notice of intent to deny, and so we only get 30 days to respond instead of 86 days to respond. There also has been a rescission of what we refer to as a deference memo. So there's this long-standing immigration policy that if this is just a routine extension of same old benefits for same old employee, same old employer, same old job, same old comp, we're going to defer to the prior decision. Not anymore. Every single filing I make is treated as a brand new filing, and we won't defer to the authority of the prior decision. So everything has to, you know, it was going to be this on extension, now it's probably going to be this. By the way, when I say this and this, I mean it, because everything is filed in paper with the agency. There are no electronic filings. This one's kind of interesting. So trying to think of an efficient way to describe it. So when we file for green card benefits, people have access to travel permission in the form of something that's referred to as advance parole. And sometimes green card processing takes so long, I have to file multiple requests for advance parole. And historically, we would just do those on kind of rotation. We'd calendar them and file them every year. And we do them about 4 months in advance of the expiration. Now the agency, without telling us, they just started denying these benefits and then later told us, yeah, that's what we're doing, it's for real, started denying the extension of the travel document if the person departed while the extension was pending. So now I'm forced to deal with a situation where I have to tell people, your green card's probably going to take 18 months instead of the 12 that we thought. By the way, your medical exam is expired. You're going to have to get another one of those. And if you want to be able to travel again between months 12 and 18, I need you to not travel between months 8 and 12 at all. It's a logistical nightmare. And so it's just an area, again, an example of something that I don't really understand the motivation. I'm not sure the agency does either. And I don't know, I'm certain that they don't appreciate the ripple effect that it's required, or that it's, that has resulted. We also now are being interviewed on every employment-based green card. There used to be a waiver of that green card interview under the theory that they've been in line for a while. An employer has sponsored them. We probably don't actually have to lay eyes on them. Now we're interviewing at the local office, who, by the way, has no experience with employment-based immigration because our employment-based benefits don't go to local offices, they go to service centers. So it's created quite the backlog for all benefits, family-sponsored and citizenship in particular at the local offices, because we've basically doubled their workload by adding on employment-based green card interviewing. There are a couple of other things that are happening at the agency level. If you have questions about them, I'm happy to respond to them, but I want to get through a few more items before we run out of time. The main thing I'll mention is the agencies, as I've said before, have always enjoyed a tremendous amount of discretion, and they are fully leveraging that ability to exercise discretion. To the extent that we ever enjoyed any benefit of the doubt, and we really haven't, we absolutely are not enjoying any benefit of the doubt these days. I don't have a lot of time to get into the details of the travel ban. This is the latest iteration. There are restrictions for foreign nationals from these countries. And my advice, regardless of whether it's people are really restricted or a little bit restricted, if you are from one of these countries, you should probably not go. There are also a couple of things that are in the works that have not yet materialized but are very much on the agenda of this administration. But I want to get a couple of things mentioned on the I-9 front, because I think it's really important to spend some time here. First and foremost, I want to make sure that you understand the distinction between a raid and an audit. So the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, along with some other Department of Homeland Security sub-agencies, have the authority to seek a warrant to investigate your work site. And if they do, it's really important that you have some comprehension and game plan for how you are going to receive these federal agencies should they show up at your work site. Sometimes they're there for a single employee, and often there's some criminal element to this. So they're there to enforce a specific warrant for a specific individual because they have a criminal history, and it's something that the agency is after. Sometimes that leads to other interests. They're going to look around if they're there, if they're inclined, but they certainly do and have. Sometimes they are there for you, not you personally, let's hope, but they're there to check out the work site. They're not there to arrest a single employee. They really are there to audit your I-9 files and business records. And they can do that if they have a warrant. And it's really important that if they do that, you understand who they are, what agency they're with, review the warrant, ask to make a copy of the warrant, make sure the warrant's signed, understand the scope of the warrant so that you are not providing anything more than you have to. And above all else, call your lawyer the minute they walk in the door. Really important for the people on the front line to understand what to do if the federal government arrives at your work site. That is to be distinguished from an audit. So I'm talking about a raid with a warrant or a subpoena signed by a judge. The other way immigration shows up is to do an audit of your files. You may not appreciate the difference in the moment for what they're there for, and they're not inclined to help you understand that distinction. So it's important that you understand what they're there for. If they're there for a raid, they'll have a warrant. If they're there for an audit, they probably won't. And it's really important that you exercise your 3-day notice period. I don't care how beautiful you think your I-9s are. I promise you they are not. With all certainty in all of my soul, I promise you that if I looked at your I-9s, I would find problems. And I really promise you that if the federal government looked at your I-9s, they'd find problems. Really important, in the absence of a warrant forcing you to surrender documents, that you exercise your right to a 3-day notice period. As a reminder, this is what you're attesting to every single time you sign an I-9 form. You or people in your workplace. You're attesting under penalty of perjury that you have examined the document presented by the employee, that the above listed documents appear to be genuine and to relate to the individual, and that to the best of my knowledge, the person is authorized to work. I've highlighted a couple of things because I think it's really important for employers to understand what their obligation is. You don't have to be a document expert. You don't have to know with absolute certainty that people are authorized to work or not authorized to work. But you do have to do this, that you have examined, that denotes some level of involvement and participation. Examined is kind of an action verb, I'd say. And that the documents appear, not that they are, but that they appear to you as a rational, breathing human being who, by the way, has read all the Q&A on I-9 Central online, that they appear to be genuine and to relate, and that to the best of my knowledge, your knowledge might be your actual knowledge, but your knowledge might also be your constructive knowledge, the things that you should have known if you'd read all the Q&A, and based on the totality of the circumstances that you understand to be relevant to the circumstance. So some employers might be inclined to just avoid this mess altogether. I'll just hire people who don't have an accent. That'll make it easier. Then I don't have to worry about it. There are a number of anti-discrimination provisions that exist within the federal law, not only Title VII, which no doubt you know, but also under the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which is what created the I-9 employment verification system to begin with. There are things that you can ask prior to making an offer, and there are things that you absolutely cannot ask prior to making an offer of employment. Some of the things that I've been talking to employers lately about are, what if travel's required and I have a feeling that this person is from, international travel's required, and I have a feeling that this person is from one of the countries under the travel ban? Great question. We should talk about that. We're not going to now, but we will if you want. Other instances that may prove problematic in the days and weeks and months to come are, what's going to happen when employees that have worked for you for 20 years under, you had no idea they had TPS, but they had TPS, are now no longer authorized to work because their employment authorization card has expired and the Trump administration has decided not to extend the program. You might want to start thinking about your workforce and changes that are potentially on the horizon for people that you thought were just fine. And they are, and they certainly were, but they may not be forever. Similarly, there are a number of people who are currently enjoying and may in the future qualify for DACA. That is very much in a state of flux. Should have some interesting news on DACA in the next couple of days. There are also instances that really create a bit of a quagmire for I-9 employment verification and compliance with respect to auto renewals that are available for employment authorization. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into that today, but if you have questions, let me know. The gist of it is, some types of employment authorization cards allow people to work continuously even when they expire, and some absolutely don't. And so it's created a bit of a mess, again, this ongoing layering of the immigration system. And, of course, keep in mind, I just heard on NPR this morning that the Department of Homeland Security is advertising the federal E-Verify program. So if you're not familiar with E-Verify, you might want to look into it to have some familiarity with it, to the extent that we have any reform in my lifetime on immigration, which I'm not holding my breath, E-Verify will be a component, no doubt. So these are the things that you're permitted to ask, or this first one is the thing that has been blessed by the federal government as something that you can ask to determine whether or not you want to extend an offer. So if you're on the fence about whether you want to go down this road, this language is something that you could ask pre-offer. Are you authorized to work in the U.S. without employer sponsorship? Yes or no. You absolutely are not permitted to ask what their current immigration status is. And for some employers, and even for employers who absolutely want to sponsor a foreign national, but we just want to know how and whether it's really possible or not, almost always those conversations are occurring after an offer has been extended, because then we can ask lots of things. We need to come up with an immigration strategy. Almost always that's happening post-offer, not pre-offer, because we're not going to get into conversations about people's country of birth and immigration status. However, there certainly is information that comes up in the course of interviewing that is mighty handy and helps us ascertain what we might do for them. So people can certainly volunteer information, and we're permitted to have conversations about volunteered information. So some things that are of particular interest to me, when I'm helping employers think through candidates, which I do from time to time, are, do we happen to know where they're from? Because the per country limitations are real and they matter and they help me ascertain what a likely strategy might be. Do we know what degree they have? Certainly we should know that from a resume in any event. Do they have a pending or an approved green card? Do they have a spouse that's pursuing green card? Are they married to a U.S. citizen? What is their employment history? How long have they been in the U.S.? These are the kinds of things we try to glean from a resume and from interviews to determine whether or not we can sponsor, because we just don't like wasting people's time unnecessarily. And a lot of foreign nationals don't have a full understanding of even what they need. Many of them are quite savvy and they know exactly what they need, but many of them don't. So this current environment is forcing us to think more creatively. The need isn't going away. We need foreign nationals to fill certain jobs. I would say on two extremes of the economy, unskilled, semi-skilled labor. Right now, I'm not really having conversations with employers about that because there's no way to lawfully emigrate in those occupations except through TPS, diversity lottery, and family-based immigration, right? That's how those jobs are getting filled at the unskilled, semi-skilled labor. I think there's little doubt about that. The opposite, at least with respect to foreign nationals. On the other end of the extreme, we're talking about people that are highly educated and have a highly specialized body of knowledge, and that we're sponsoring them on that other extreme. And so we're thinking about, we have no immediate non-immigrant temporary visa pass available to them, so we're just jumping right to green card. That's not a quick process. It's a rather uncertain process, but sometimes it's the only option for people who have an MBA and are filling a role that nobody else can fill. Just had that conversation with a client yesterday, entire team utterly devastated, and so, you know, we might be thinking about green card sponsorship. He's probably gonna have to go home for a time, but we might be able to get him back. O-1 is for extraordinary ability. That's another temporary visa path. We're using a lot more than we used to. It is challenging set of criteria, but we use it from time to time. And frankly, a whole lot of people are going back to school. So if we can't find an immediate way to sponsor a foreign national, then they're going on to get graduate education or second and third master's degrees sometimes. I'd say with respect to retention, so when you have someone that you've sponsored for immigration benefits and you have navigated this path or you think you have a solid strategy, I would encourage you to be thoughtful with your immigration counsel about what plan B looks like. We are in an extraordinarily uncertain time with respect to immigration benefits. And the nature of my practice has always been to contemplate plan B. But I would say now it is utterly essential. We are getting denials and requests for evidence on cases for people who have been here for more than a decade that, in, by all accounts, should have received an extension of status for a routine, uneventful, uninteresting extension benefit, and we're getting a lot of pushback from the agency. So I would say now nothing is really certain. And then think about what your policy priorities are as an employer. Are you going to sponsor people for green card? When are you going to sponsor people for green card? Are you going to cover the family in addition to your primary applicant employee? People are feeling quite vulnerable, foreign nationals, and it's important for you to understand and help them understand what you are and what you are not prepared to do on their behalf. We're also filing a lot more appeals than we ever had before, and I shudder to think that I may end up in federal court appealing a decision. If for no other reason, that's a really great thing for being in a big firm, so I don't actually have to be the one to do it. I'll be the expert witness behind the scenes, I hope. Did you have a question? So the question was, if they're going back to school for the lack of immediate immigration benefits, are they permitted to work while they're seeking additional education? I would say generally no, at least in the beginning, because most programs require you to immerse yourself into whatever the educational program is, at least for the first semester of the first year. A couple of exceptions, if there's extreme hardship, financial hardship, if there's... If the nature of the program requires some employment opportunity, that might be an exception. There also are some universities who I think are pushing the envelope about these rules. And so every once in a while, and immigration's well aware of them and is pursuing them and probably will decertify them from being able to accept foreign students, but that's kind of an ongoing issue. Usually foreign students can work during the summer, during breaks, and after their initial year, they can work on a part-time basis. So full-time during the summer, part-time during the academic year is generally the rule. And then upon graduation, they can get employment authorization, of course, for 1 year. Unless they have a STEM degree, then they can get three. Yes.
So if you're
so this is not H-1B requirement. This would be green card requirement. And through a labor certification, you would sponsor a foreign national, and you'd conduct this labor market test. I'm honing and repeating your question for the benefit of the audio. So green card sponsorship, you get a U.S. applicant, but they are demanding a higher salary than what is posted for the offered position. Is that your question? So no, you are not required to offer it to the U.S. applicant. The job is offered at the location that it's offered and at the compensation level. But what you can't do is dismiss the U.S. applicant under the theory that he wouldn't accept a lesser degree. So if the foreign or the U.S. applicant, I'm sorry, states in a cover letter what their salary expectation is and your actual offered compensation is lower than that, you have to actually call the person and say, well, in fact, the offered compensation is here. Are you still interested? And he or she has to opt out. You can't just automatically draw the conclusion that, well, he said his offer, he said his salary expectation was higher. Yeah. So a couple of things for you to think through. Really important to make more thoughtful hiring decisions. And think through whether or not to the extent that federal law permits you to, whether you want to sponsor foreign nationals. That has always been my advice, as I mentioned before. That is especially true under this environment. You are signing up for even more than whatever you were signing up before when you sponsor foreign nationals. So it's really important that you're thoughtful about that before you embark down that road. With respect to your foreign national population that is employed by you, encourage them, strongly encourage them to check their I-94 admission records through CBP's website. CBP at the time of entry used to give foreign nationals a little white card that they would staple on their passport. They don't do that anymore. And it sounds great that we're moving to an electronic system, except then nobody looks at the electronic system and we find out too late that in fact they were admitted in the wrong category or they were admitted for a lesser period of time than we thought and now are subject to a 3 or a 10 year bar because they've overstayed and they didn't even know it. And so it's really important that we encourage people to check their records immediately upon every return to the U.S. And for frequent flyers, that is a monster pain in the rear. But I just can't emphasize enough how important it is. I'm mentioning international travel mostly with respect to people from certain designated countries for whom that might be complicated. So travel ban countries in particular, but it's something to be mindful of. The times that I encounter trouble with respect to U.S. immigration, often there's a travel component to it that has screwed something up. And so it's much easier when people just stay put. And I don't like restricting people's travel, but I will if I feel that it's in their best interest. So just having some awareness, is this an employee that travels a lot or not at all? And is it necessary? And necessary means personally and professionally, of course, but just something to be mindful of. Really important that we are thoughtful about what immigration compliance requires of us when we're sponsoring foreign nationals. Almost all visa categories, temporary non-immigrant visa categories, are limited to the particular sponsoring employer. So we don't shadow and work part-time at Walgreens. We're only authorized to work for this employer, we're not picking up hours somewhere else. So it's employer-specific, it's job-specific, and it's location-specific. And there's often a wage component. You can always give raises. You can always pay people more, but you can't pay people less typically for when we're sponsoring them for immigration benefits. There's been a lot of misnomers and just a lot of misinformation out about what's happening or not happening. So I have to remind myself and our team and employers often to check news sources. So just another reminder there. The immigrant community tends to maintain close contact with one another. And so there are things that just sort of percolate up. And then when I really get to the source, I realize, oh yeah, that's not actually legitimate at all. This is an area that's sort of ripe for bad news and for people to frankly be taken advantage of. There's been a huge uptick in fraud cases, so. And to the extent that you are inclined, to the extent that you have, an immigration experience, I encourage you to share that with our members of Congress. It is really important that they hear what your experiences are. I'm afraid that they don't hear enough experiences for people who are on the front lines of the immigration realities of our U.S. economy. And they don't want to hear from me as a lawyer. They want to hear from you who are actually having the experiences. They also often hear from the extremes, the extremely good, the extremely bad. And so it's really important that they hear the everyday narrative as well. Couple of resources to the extent that you want to follow the news a little bit more that I'm sharing here. And then the other thing that I'll mention is that we try to maintain our website. We've got a whole immigration page devoted on ICE-Miller's website under a Choose Talent tab. We try to put kind of the latest and greatest on there. So a fair amount of resources and things. So to the extent that you have interest there. I just, by the way, recorded, my partner and I just did an I-9 compliance webinar the other day. And it literally runs through the nuts and bolts of employment verification, I-9 compliance in painstaking detail. So if you want to listen to that webinar, it's on our website as well. It will tell you exactly how you're supposed to fill out the form and some things to watch out for so you can get that. There's a live link to that webinar if you want to download it. What questions do you have? I think we've got some time. So I definitely want to hear what is on your minds. In the back. So the question, yeah. So the question was, how is an employer to react when an employee comes forward and says, "So-and-so employee is not legal"? I would suggest that you tell the employee that the company, and I'm going to presume this is true, that the company takes quite seriously its I-9 employment verification obligations, and thank the employee for the information. Perhaps ask the employee if there's particular information that he or she might have that has allowed the employee to draw this conclusion, And then depending on what that is, you may or absolutely may not decide to do something more about it. When we think about immigration's enforcement of I-9 obligations, I mentioned before, your knowledge level is really important, and it's actual knowledge and constructive knowledge. And it's this sort of thing that becomes a data point on whether you have sufficient constructive knowledge that would require you to terminate employment or not. But I would say to you, it is really hard to know whether someone's authorized to work or not, and whether they were at the time of hire, and whether they continue to be authorized for employment. And you, all the time, I am asking employers, send me the I-9, tell me everything you know or think you know, and then we will draw a conclusion together about whether or not we should have a follow-up conversation with the employee who is allegedly undocumented. And honest to goodness, it could go either way. And the problem is, if you terminate and the person is authorized for employment, well, now we have to worry about whether or not we're going to be pursued on a discrimination claim, right? If we don't, and because we feel like we don't have enough information to terminate employment, then we have to worry about this groundswell that may or may not be happening within the employment setting, that this issue is never going to go away. And so next it's some other employee, and the next week it's some other employee. So we have to take them seriously. But what you do depends on what else you know, and probably what the I-9 looks like. So I probably would pull the I-9, make sure you have one, right? God forbid somebody comes to you and says, so-and-so's illegal, and then you go look at your I-9 forms and you realize, oops, he snuck through, we forgot. It was a bad HR day, and that guy somehow was hired and put to work without an I-9. So let's make sure we've got an I-9. And then to the extent that you kept copies of documents, because some employers do, some don't, by the way, I advocate for keeping copies of documents with the I-9, look at the documents that were accepted. Do you feel good about them? So all of this becomes a part of the totality of the circumstances. I've been working with on U.S. immigration for, like I said, since the mid-90s, and I can have conversations all day long about what someone's immigration status is, what their perception of their immigration status is, but until I see their documents, it's meaningless. I can't tell from accents. I can't tell by how they conduct themselves. I can't tell by how they hold themselves. I can't tell by the words they use. I can't tell by the way they characterize their immigration journey. The only way I really know is by looking at their documents. And even still, sometimes I don't know. Then I have to look it up because I just can't quite get to the bottom because of all that. My other page, my other forms of lawful presence, that is wide and deep, in a way that I have not bothered to fully entrench myself in because I got enough other stuff to do. So it is a challenging question. But I think for purposes of immediate reaction, the employee needs to be made to understand that we take it seriously. What do you know or what do you think you know? And we'll check it out. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the question was, they're so inspired by this talk, they go back into an internal audit of their I-9s. What do you do when you find stuff that's not quite up to snuff? So I have, in fact, on this webinar, I just did a whole series of slides and talking points devoted to how to correct I-9s. So I'd encourage you to think about that. But high level, quick response. You can make changes to Section 2. Employee only can make changes to Section 1. Section 1's for the employee, Section 2's for the employer. You can't fix their stuff. It's your responsibility to know when they mess it up, and it's your responsibility to ensure that they fix it, but they have to be the one to fix it if it's a Section 1 error. If it's a Section 2 error, you can fix it. There are some things you can't cure. So the employee forgot to date it. We're not going to backdate. We don't backdate. But we might be able to talk through with the employee do you happen to know when you signed it? Maybe we could add an annotation to the margin that says he forgot to date it, but we think it was this date and initial. So it really kind of depends on what the issue is, but it's really important, in addition to being thoughtful about what could be construed as substantive violations of employment verification, like we accepted documents that we really shouldn't have. The other part of I-9 compliance that's perhaps equally important, sort of with an asterisk and a footnote, is just the technical work, just the paperwork. There are lots of instances in which I can mitigate lots of other bad stuff because your paperwork's in good shape. It at least indicates to the government, you tried, we're really trying. We went to an I-9 employment verification compliance seminar and I tried to correct these things. The other thing to know is that you can't use whiteout. You can't black things out. You have to single line corrections and date and initial them. I will also say a late I-9 is always better than no I-9. So you don't backdate it. So it's late, but late's better than none. So just do it when just make the discovery. Was there a question over here? Go ahead.
I just want to make sure I understand the difference between the H-1B process and the path to getting the green card.
Okay. Yes.
So with the H-1B, that's just a pathway to get temporary employment authorization, and that's completely separate from the labor certification portion of getting a green card, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, and the labor certification, you said, has much higher requirements to meet in order to get that than the H-1B temporary work authorization?
Yeah. So the question is, H-1B is different from labor certification path to green card. That's absolutely correct. So H-1B is for temporary sponsorship, maxes out at 6 years. I can request it in 3-year increments. And I can get more H-1B time beyond the normal 6-year limit if I have timely initiated a green card sponsorship. So for an employer who only wants to employ somebody for 6 years or less, we may never get to green card. I can say, by the way, that almost never happens. If an employer is making a decision to sponsor a foreign national for H-1B, we're almost always eventually sponsoring them for green card. Now, if I could marry them all off to U.S. citizens, I absolutely would, because labor certification stinks. It's a horrible process. We have to put ads in the paper. We have to vet the U.S. Workforce. It's tedious. It's unforgiving. It's zero tolerance. So every I dotted, every T crossed, the Department of Labor is no holds barred on it. And they're really, really strict on it because the volume is such that they don't have time to be nice. So, yes, very different. You could sponsor someone for H-1B and never sponsor them for green card, but you certainly could, and you usually do, I would say. What other questions do you all have? Go ahead. Yeah, so the question is if there are changes to the terms or conditions of employment, so address change, or even let's say they leave you and they want to go work for another employer, or the job changes, an amendment is required. And so we are filing an amendment to the H-1B petition, which from a practical, just functional level, looks identical to the initial petition. I just don't have to go through the lottery and the quota issues and only file a certain time a year. Once you've been counted against the H-1B quota, you're counted. So amendments aren't subject to that. But again, because we've eliminated this deference memo, I have to treat every filing as if it's brand new, and it better be good enough to stand on its own. So when you talk about changing jobs in particular, be thoughtful about this degree issue. Does the new job still require the degree that the applicant holds? Could get denied. Yes, and you've destroyed their life. I had to give a little drama. Okay, go ahead. Yes. Yes. I'm sorry, by the way. My sympathies to you.
Um,
Very good question. So she's asking about the H-2B visa category. So it is for seasonal employment. And so when I said before there are virtually no visa paths for unskilled, semi-skilled labor, she's raising the one path. And my sympathies are extended to her because it's a terrible process. It is really excruciating. So the labor market testing that we do for permanent green card sponsorship, labor certification, we do that for seasonal employment. So when we want to sponsor someone for seasonal employment in this country, we require employers for unskilled, semi-skilled job, which by definition probably doesn't have any requirements because we really just need breathing humans who pass our drug tests. We have to conduct a labor market test to prove no U.S. workers qualified or available to just do seasonal work, which again is like 4, 6, 8 months, something like that. So your question is, once you've, there's a quota associated with H-2B as well. If you're counted one season, do you have to go through that again the second season? I'm hesitating because A, I don't do that work because I all but refuse to do it because it's awful. B, the Department of Labor changed the rule and I don't remember what the rule is now. But if you want to email me, I'll confirm for you. But I assume that you're working with someone because if you're doing that on your own, I'm nominating you for martyrdom. Okay, what other questions? Anything else? No? All right, enjoy your lunch, enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you so much.